Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that has a 12-step plan to ensure it sticks to its resolutions. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
We also have, in New York, on the 4th of July weekend, it's Patrick Cook. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Corey and Steve. How are we?
We're pretty good. Well, I'm pretty... I don't know why I'm speaking to Steve, because I haven't seen him in 4 months. I'm pretty good. Cricket's coming back this week. There's a test match that by the time this episode comes out, England will probably have already lost.
So we'll be going back to normal.
Baseball's coming back as well, and I'm excited.
Patrick is here. Now, usually, obviously, that means we're going to talk about the idiocy of Donald Trump, but we're not going to do that. We're going to do something different and talk about UK politics in this one. Because, guys, it's now July. We are now more than halfway through 2020, and I did the maths before coming on, and we are, in fact, the dreaded number of 52% through 2020.
Oh, God.
Who knows what the 48% has in store? But what Steve and I did in January, before COVID, as if such a time exists, we gave Labour, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, New Year's resolutions that we thought that they should try and follow in 2020. Did any of them stick to our advice? Conservatives first, because they are in government after all, allegedly. So we had three resolutions to the Conservatives, and for ease, I think I'm going to stick the first two together because they're quite interrelated. So first resolution we have for the Conservatives was to keep their voting coalition together. It's going to be hard to know given that there are no elections going on at the moment, but we can look at that towards the end of the year if we are looking at the polls. Second resolution we had was get an agenda. Now, this we can talk about, and it seems like the Tories have some sort of agenda. And one of the reasons we wanted Patrick to talk about this is because Boris Johnson and Michael Gove have been talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. And Boris Johnson and Michael Gove have said that they want to be Rooseveltian. Patrick, as the resident expert on FDR on this podcast, what have you made of Boris Johnson's claims to be like Franklin Roosevelt?
I'm a big fan of the New Deal because it is the best way to come out of a recession. But the one issue that I've saw is the related to the cultural side of the economy. An example of the New Deal under Works Progress Administration, a bunch of other stuff, they spent a solid amount of public money to build the cultural industries of the United States that to this day does a... For example, Carl Reiner, who just recently passed away, got his start in acting by way of an apprenticeship through the Works Progress Administration in culture for acting. It's really good to see, but it has to be done somewhat efficiently. You need to target area of infrastructure projects or stuff that's going to have a long-term net benefit for the country. Tax cuts are important, but the idea is that you deficit spend knowing that at the end you will end up having you'll have a bigger return that's going to be able to cover the increase on bonds. The goal being, if private industry is not going to spend and individuals aren't going to spend, then the only other person that can spend is the government and taking advantage of really low bond rates, which is what we're currently in right now. But they have to be done for things that are going to provide a long-term one, be it HS2, be it rebuilding railroads, be it, water infrastructure and stuff like that. What I find a little bit concerned with is the Michael Gove, Boris Johnson version of the Rooseveltian one is it seems to not super be targeted to things that will end up strengthening manufacturing or stuff or long-term stuff for the UK government. It seems to be things like unemployment benefits and all these other stuff that are good in the long run, but doesn't create a structural change to the economy. And the reason that probably isn't true is it takes a lot of money to do those kind of structural appointments. And I think it's an issue that now we're pretty far into some related to conservative government, you know, almost 10 years into conservative-led governments, is that the long-term planning for the national economic infrastructure seems to not be there to, if you had the money, what projects did you want to do, which is a problem the U.S. is running into at the same time. But it seems like it is not the most efficient one, like, or this should have all been done getting ready for leaving Brexit. There should have been a build of stuff that's going to make their certain industries they want to target it more, you know, efficient and effective, that's going to lower the cost of business. And my concern is looking through it quickly, I seem to see the public relations of a lot of money spent on a lot of stuff to show that we're investing in one, but is it targeted at the most efficient use of it, where the government is actually doing the project instead of giving it, providing low-cost loans and low-cost funds for private industry to do stuff, which is usually less efficient? It's good to see. It's important, but they could have done this 2 years ago, 4 years ago, when they agreed to leave the European Union. It's going to be hard to see that they're going to be able to, you know, with this kind of expense funding, see a net return within the next year, when they can take advantage of, you know, of an economic downturn to come out stronger or faster than other countries. But it seems good, but I don't think they super understand FDR and what he did, which included a huge expansion of the government infrastructure to create the plans that he won that lasted for about 30, 40 years. And then, you know, it was a ton of money that the U.S. spent to become, to this day, still the strongest economy in the world.
I don't think they've necessarily understood what the New Deal was and what it was about. But I think what they've essentially done is they've just tried to appropriate the feeling and the expectations of what invoking FDR and the New Deal brings for people, because I think it's one of the bits of American history that I think that we do get taught, at least in some form in schools. At least it was something that I definitely did, and I didn't do a lot of American history. I think there's a degree of familiarity with it, that people know that it was a drastic change in how the American government ended up kind of being shaped as a result of FDR's New Deal. But I think they're trying to invoke that feeling, but not for the same kind of end point that FDR was aiming for. Because FDR obviously was aimed at trying to end the Great Recession, massively change the infrastructure of the government, invest in the economy for long-term success. Now, when you look actually about... So when Michael Gove gave the first speech, where this focus on the New Deal arrived and was spoken about, one of the first things they started going on about was, oh, we're going to be reforming the civil service. Immediately, to my mind, this screams, oh, they're just trying to find a new way to reframe the same things that they've been wanting to do anyway, just to try and make it a bit more politically saleable or make it feel like there's actually a political narrative there, rather than it's just, oh, it's the same thing that every government's done, which is try to reform the civil service in some form, because they keep on going, oh, the civil service is stopping us from doing what we want to do, when in reality, the civil service is just there to serve you for the most part. Yes, there probably are issues with it, but, you know, it's kind of survived in the way it has for so long because it actually functions and functions very well for the most part. They are, as I say, trying to appropriate kind of like the image and the history of FDR's New Deal without actually aiming for the same end point, because fundamentally the New Deal and FDR's aim was to make people's lives better. It was to try and improve the long-term welfare and health of the economy of America. All of the things that they've been kind of talking about in relation to this so far haven't necessarily been kind of going down that path. It's been, oh, we're going to do civil service reform. Well, that's not going to have a single bit of impact on most people's everyday lives unless you're a civil servant or a politician. They've started talking about, oh, yeah, we're going to do home building. And they've said, oh, yeah, we're going to put, I think it's $1 billion into new homes and things, which is fine and sounds good as an initial headline. But when you actually look at their previous budgets and previous kind of financial statements, well, the last one said they were going to do $2.4 billion. So they've actually reduced the amount that they were looking to spend. That's not very New Deal of them, to be honest. It's all of this seems to be, to my ears and eyes, an attempt to try and reframe the narrative in a way that's a bit more meaningful for the government, so that they can just try and latch on to something that they can kind of use as the focus for their comms and kind of like policy announcements moving forward, in attempt to make it seem like they've got a plan, when in reality, I don't think they really do have a plan. I think they are just kind of going at this kind of like a headless, running around like a headless chicken, in an attempt to try and kind of have discussions that aren't about coronavirus, that aren't about Brexit, and that they can hopefully try and spin in a more positive way. Remains to be seen exactly how successful they'll be at that. But certainly, I think if FDR was around today to hear, to kind of analyse and look at what the government, what the UK government was doing, in kind of comparing to what he did, he'd be kind of rolling his eyes at them, because it's nowhere near what he did. And to be honest, it's kind of farcical for them to try and draw that comparison.
If FDR was still alive, he would still be president after about 25 terms.
That is true.
But I digress.
If you're going to go on this one, which is government one, a government intervention in the economy, the last thing you want to do is say, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to completely change all these departments. FDR inherited a government and series of mechanisms that were established during Herbert Hoover and Woodrow Wilson administrations. He didn't particularly just go through and say, well, I got a bunch of political appointees and all that kind of stuff. If you're planning on wanting to infuse money into the economy and do it at the most efficient, the last thing you want to do is spend time, and it will take solid time, reforming the civil service, and then you have brain drain of people that have been there trying to plan these things for a long time. The other thing too is that there probably is something to be said related to homes. Is a good example of it, is that one of the things in New Deal that they did was they also built a bunch of new stuff, but they realized if they wanted to do what the United States, we in the United States could refer to as shovel ready, spent a solid amount of money of rejuvenating and reinvigorating existing infrastructure, be it water ones, be it wastewater treatment plants, public housing and stuff like that, because those are very important. Maybe you don't have the political narrative that you want, that showing you building a new house, but you can make faster turnaround and show better economic one by repairing and renovating things you already exist to work better, be it paving roads, be it rail lines, be it existing social housing. And sometimes it's not always the most glitziest, we're going to build this new hospital, we're going to build this new bridge.
It is the Johnson administration, so yes, bridges are almost certainly going to appear in some form.
Yeah, I first will be excited to drive to Northern Ireland on a car. you saw this under Theresa May's government too, and even under, if Corbyn, for example, had gotten into government. And the same thing is, they go for these big, takes 4 to 5 years to build it, that will end up doing it because that's what people want to see. They want to see people building. But there's a lot of other stuff, what I refer to as less sexy versions of the New Deal, which was simple things of like renovating existing infrastructure to be more efficient because it's a faster turnaround for economic generating. And I don't tend to exactly see it. That's exactly what you'll lose if you try to reform the civil service, is you'll have people that have been around here that have these kind of things of like small things that need to be done if the money was available that will make an impact on someone's life or something like that. And it tends to be full of these really, really big projects that are great to have, but not a lot of the small things that would be, that are much more impactful to the running of government or improving a community.
Yeah, we don't tend to talk about shovel-ready projects here. We tend to talk about oven-ready deals.
Which go in the microwave.
Oh, that's it.
Lots of things here. But I think what's also interesting, Patrick, is the link you made between austerity and Brexit, because a lot of evidence that Brexit votes were higher in areas that had more cuts. And so one of the things the Tories have to do in terms of keeping this voting coalition together is somehow keep fiscal conservatives, you know, people living in the south who are quite well off, don't really want government spending, with people in Birmingham Northfield, who Gary Sandbrook, MP for Birmingham Northfield, was writing the Times Red Box talking about how we needed spades in the ground and more government projects. And I think the Tories are aware that these people who voted in these sort of red wall seats have felt left behind for a while and needed a bit more investment. The problem is, I think, as you both hinted, is that the scale of this just isn't there. Today, on the day we're recording this, the government has announced £1.5 billion to support the arts and culture sector, which is great and needed and necessary. But then 40,000 actors were employed by the government to perform plays for the unemployed. You know, it was just a massive ambition that just isn't here in the Tory programme. A lot of this money from housing in this Johnson speech was old money anyway. It had already been allocated by the budget. You didn't need to announce it in another speech. And even a lot of the money that is now coming to schools to rebuild, I think Stuart Wood, who's a former advisor for Gordon Brown, tweeted this out, that 10 years ago, the Labour government had a Building Schools for the Future programme, which was axed by Gove and Cummings when Gove went into education 10 years ago. And lo and behold, 10 years on, the government is announcing £1 billion programme to help repair schools. I think the civil service thing, though, is really quite, I think it's quite scary, because you've got Mark Sedwell, who was the cabinet secretary, being removed from the National Security Advisor post and being replaced by someone who doesn't, David Frost, who doesn't have any national security experience. And there's also plans, I think, that press officers are going to be sacked and they're going to bring in daily press briefings led by an experienced broadcaster. So I don't know if, Steve, you've been tapped up for this already. as you said, Patrick, trying to reform the civil service while you're dealing with a pandemic, while you're also trying to kickstart the economy, just feels like you're spreading yourself so thin that the agenda will just end up kind of going into incoherence. And you can sort of see that with, you know, Cummings likes the idea of science and wants everything to be sort of scientifically backed up. But then there's also claims that the government's trying to water down its green credentials and any zero carbon initiatives it's got. And you think, well, if anything is going to be based on science, then surely action on climate change can be top of the list. So it ends up not really being based on science, but on the prejudices of Dominic Cummings.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things with the civil service stuff is it's the sort of thing which is going to be unpopular actually amongst the government's own benches, potentially. I mean, we've already had quite a sight of seeing Theresa May in the House of Commons basically just lay into the government and say, hey, you've gotten rid of Mark Sedwell, who was the National Security Advisor, somebody who had experience, somebody with relevant qualifications, all of that sort of stuff, and you've replaced him with a political appointment who has no experience. I get this odd feeling that if they do try and go down a route of more kind of political appointments for these sorts of things, a la like the American system, then they're going to be in for a bit of a shock, because I suspect the actual Conservatives with a small C in the Conservative Party are not going to back it.
Patrick, and no disrespect to you or your great country, but I'm not sure at the moment I would look at America and think, there's a functioning political system. That's what I want to roll out in my country too.
Funny, I was about to say that. Reforming civil service to make it more political appointees feels like it's just full of unintended consequences.
Most like the New Deal. I think even if we are maybe not entirely agreement in how the government's doing it, they are maybe trying to fulfill the first two resolutions. The third resolution was to keep Brexit off the front pages. And I would argue they've basically succeeded with this. On the other hand, we are only, as I say, 52% of the way through the year. And I imagine if we were to check in on this in about 4 or 5 months' time, Brexit will be very much on the front pages and part of the government's agenda. Are we generally agreed that government has kept Brexit off the front pages? The deadline to extend the transition seems to have come and gone with nary a peep.
I think a large part of that's due to the coronavirus rather than their own skill. But yes, essentially, they have succeeded in that.
They saved themselves a reprieve for about a couple of months. But once this settles out and it becomes related to more focused on how to rebuild the economy, it's going to come back to bite them probably even harder than it would have been if they didn't have the pandemic to talk about.
That's the Conservatives then. So Labour now. We also gave Labour three resolutions. The first one was to engage honestly and comradely about why we lost the last election. And I'm going to say, because there's this I don't know if either of you have had a chance to read it. There's a Labour Together report that's been done, which is a really, really interesting post-mortem. It's got submissions from all sectors of the party. I can't claim to have read every dot and comma, as apparently our new General Secretary has, David Evans, but it's a genuine, I think, really good, really interesting, really honest look at the failings of Labour in the run-up to the election and in the election itself, which we've covered to death on the podcast. I don't necessarily want to talk about them already. But then also talks about a blueprint for the future in terms of how to put together a voting coalition, reforming the party on the ground as well, campaigning, which I find particularly interesting.
Certainly that document seems to have done quite a decent job of starting the discussion about what we need, about what Labour needs to do moving forward to try and become more electable. And the fact that pretty much every kind of like faction within the Labour Party was able to go, this document is fair. Like, there's some stuff we agree with it quite strongly on. There's other stuff we're less inclined to agree with. But everybody seemed to be kind of talking about it in a way that says, yeah, this isn't a stitch up. This is legit.
I think it's the same kind of concepts of where the Democrats were like in 2014, is that they had these high level of ideas that they wanted to do, but they had not done the important things that keeps you elected. It's the local campaigning. It's the listening to your local councillors to tell you that are your best bet to know what's going on in the community. Proper messaging and proper campaign strategy is based on your community that you're one. You know, one fits all campaigning doesn't really work.
Yeah, and so I think one of the things that's most interesting in that Labour Together report is about how we try and root that campaigning in our local communities from now on. The second resolution we had was, and I can't believe we wrote this, this makes it sound like soothsayers, Steve. We need to say that Labour needed a constructive way to attack the Tories. And gosh darn it, Steve, if Keir Starmer hasn't set himself on being constructive in opposition.
Yeah, it is one of the rarities where it looks like we might have got a prediction, I suppose you might call it, right?
If we actually think that Keir Starmer's following our advice, Labour might be even more screwed than we thought.
Maybe in a couple of weeks' time, we'll just find Sir Keir as on the Patreon list.
Is there a crystal ball in the bunker?
Do you remember the photo from Trump in Saudi Arabia and that orb? It kind of looks a bit like that. Yeah, we just stand around in this massive glow.
It's kind of impressive that he's able to do what he does with an 80-seat majority, and on top of the focus being on coronavirus and breakthrough, that there's so much news about what's going on in the UK related to coronavirus and the pandemic in general, that he's able to break through, be constructive, and get his message across is kind of impressive.
Yeah, it is quite impressive. I mean, one of the things I've been most surprised by pleasantly surprised by is the fact that Starmer and Labour's kind of like polling position, but mainly Starmer's actually, and this is the really interesting thing, Starmer's kind of like polling position himself keeps on getting better and better as time is going on, to the point where as of the last poll I saw on this, he was now outpolling Boris Johnson for preferred Prime Minister. Or it's a testament, I think, to the hard work and his skill and the skill of his team, but also the screw-ups that the government's had as well. Sorry, oppositions don't win elections necessarily. Governments just tend to lose them. And I think we're kind of seeing a lot of that kind of playing out in this as well.
Also, I really like today that Keir Starmer was in Brewdog and definitely brandishing a can of the Barnard Castle eye test beer.
That's amazing.
His plan, and this leads on to the third resolution we had, which was to try and find a path to electability. And the Labour Together, the review, talks about this as well. But I think Starmer's definitely got his eye on those Red Wall voters. And as you say, Steve, the Starmer's personal ratings are sort of outperforming the Labour brand at the moment. But what I think Starmer's definitely set himself the task of doing is trying to rebuild trust with the Labour Party in these Red Wall seats, where traditional Labour areas where we saw a loss of support.
It's quite notable that there hasn't been a outright repudiation of the Corbynite manifesto, and there has actually been some attempts to reconfirm commitment to certain policies, but they're just going to present it in a more focused way.
Forensic way.
Strategic, you might say.
One would say he's soliciting.
Thank you, Patrick. that's man after my own heart.
On the Labour and Keir Starmer, electability is that Scotland, while it is an incredibly tough thing for them to do, there hasn't really been discussions on how having to work, they need to probably most likely work to Lib Dems because they have a very, very important Hollywood election coming up next year. There hasn't been super discussions of how, what to do north of the border. That's one thing I've seen, and not really anything that has put them towards electability that requires getting seats outside of England.
That's an excellent point, Patrick. I'm sure that Ian Murray, former pub quiz host and Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland, is working on something. Talking about the Lib Dems, though, brings us on to, hello, Mark, brings us on to the final resolution we had. This was that the Lib Dems had to find a way to be relevant. There is a leadership election going on at the moment between Ed Davey and Leila Moran.
The election is happening. It was delayed It's quite a fair amount due to the coronavirus situation, which seems to be kind of descending into the ye old fashioned Orange Booker versus Social Democrat debate from time immemorial. As it stands, Davey hasn't necessarily been making a lot of waves in terms of wider media from what I can see. Whenever I come across Lib Dem stuff online, it seems to be more Leila Moran centric. Leila Moran has been actively trying to court public attention in various forms. She's made some interesting statements about trying to win Corbynite support, or rather the support of former Corbyn supporters, by virtue of electing Starmer. Labour will end up being less radical than the Liberal Democrats. But at the same time, seemingly realising that actually a lot of the seats that the Lib Dems need to win are Conservative facing. She started putting out some plans for how you win those sorts of seats. She's also pushed out a kind of a policy document and kind of book similar to, say, the Orange Book and Reinventing the State back from the coalition years, which is, it looks like it's going to probably be the basis of her kind of like policy approach if she is elected leader. So this, she's been doing an awful lot, and I can see why that is leading to excitement about her as a potential leader from among the grassroots of the Lib Dem membership. It's just too early to say from my perspective where everything is. It certainly seems to me as an outsider now that Moran seems to have more of the momentum behind her with a small M.
I don't know if Ed Davey will have the stink of the coalition. Another thing, the thing that I tend to find out that Ed Davey, reading about after what had, you know, after the last election, is Ed Davey was more along the lines of doing the Lexexy parts of things. And, you know, as we always know, that the Lib Dem leader doesn't actually has control over policy, but between the CEO and the party president, hello, Mark, it's kind of a very different setup. And I do think that, like, the more traditional voters of the Liberal Democrats, either could be the, you know, Social Democrats and stuff like that, the older that established part one tend to be favoring Ed over Leila. But the newer increase of stuff that was here for related to radical things like back bollocks to Brexit and various different things that tend to be favoring Leila. But it also feels like Ed doesn't exactly need to do this stand, the kind of flashy media, because he's kind of known. He was deputy leader. He's well known from being a coalition minister, but also, like, he also has done stuff that you could say the same thing that Leila can say related to taking a non-targeted seat and winning and increasing the majority every time, and then coming back again after losing in 2015 to win it again in 2017. So there's, like, it does kind of feel that if you go through reading on this stuff, and I try to follow both on Twitter to get an understanding, that Ed's more plan is, we have a path forward with the election review. We are on a one. We need to focus on local. All politics is local. Where Leila is more of the kind of similar thing that probably along with Boris Johnson, of saying the larger themes, the one to get people to show that she knows what she's talking about. You know, I don't know what's going to, not knowing and not being involved in the Liberal Democrats, I'm not sure how that breaks down in terms of who actually votes in a party election, what works and what are the kind of voters and how they vote and what do you need to tell them to them. But it seems like Ed's message in 2017 of working with Labour, now mind you, wasn't really helpful because of Corbyn, but seems like it's more closer to what you see on Twitter related to prominent Lib Dems of they understand the purposes that Labour, much as we don't like them, we're going to need to work and find some kind of beneficial relationship with them so that we can all be successful.
An awful lot of like your establishment, for lack of a better term, Dems were backing Davey. So I think they had, at least at the time, Davey had more support amongst, like, you know, members of the House of Lords, MPs, you know, London Assembly members, those sorts of things. Whilst Leila Moran was doing better amongst the actual kind of grassroots members and getting the backing of like local Lib Dem parties and things like that. Your kind of like focus point there on like, oh yeah, Ed Davey seems to realise that yes, Lib Dems and Labour need to kind of work together in some form. That probably is accurate. My suspicion is that's not a message that will go down well with a lot of Lib Dem members, though, because there is a genuine belief amongst the Lib Dems, based on what I saw when I was a member, that Labour aren't the radical party, the Lib Dems are the radical party, and you know, Labour are just in effect, you know, they're either Tony Blair, it's either going to be Tony Blair or Corbyn. It's going to be somebody who can't be trusted because they're too authoritarian, or they can't be trusted because they're too right-wing, or whatever. There is no love lost between the Lib Dems and Labour, and I suspect that will kind of show through if that is a kind of a major talking point that Davey is going for.
There was a breakdown of Davey endorsements and Leila Moran endorsements from, I think, is it Lib Dem, whatever the Lib Dem equivalent is of CLPs and affiliated societies and what have you. I think Ed Davey was on about 1,500 and Leila Moran was on about 1,100. I know in Labour, usually CLP endorsements are quite a decent measure of how they're going to perform in a future election. I don't know how it translates for Lib Dems. But the thing I just find so bemusing at the moment is Leila Moran's plan to essentially try and outflank Labour from the left. So you end up, essentially, you've got the Lib Dem SDP problem writ large, in that you end up with a party that's got a small increase in support all across the country, but not enough to win any seats. Whereas, as we've said before, 26 out of the 30 marginal seats that the Lib Dems could take are Tory held. And how that plan was supposed to win any support and how he's supposed to grow Lib Dem seats, I have absolutely no idea. As you say, she sort of rode back on it. But I just find it incredibly bemusing. If Keir Starmer did want to have more of our advice, Steve, and other, you know, Labour figures, even Leila Moran, if she wanted to join, become a champagner, she could come to our Patreon page, couldn't she, Steve?
She could indeed. She could head over to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, where she could for us a few quid every month, gain access to unique content and podcast episodes that only our patrons and champagners over there get, early access to articles, unique articles, all kinds of fun and games over there. So head over, take a look. That's patreon.com/notenoughchampagne.
Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm @paperbackrioter.
I'm @acousticradical.
I'm @pcook11.
Happy plotting.